Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Panel, Business and Marketing Strategies for Genetic Laboratories in the Current Market. The presenters are Emily Johnson, Member, McDonald Hopkins LLC, Chicago, Illinois, Valerie Palmieri, CEO Founder, Momentum Consulting, Monroe, Connecticut, Michael Vishnevetsky, PhD, SVP Business Development, Fabric Genomics, Oakland, California, and Patrick Walsh, Managing Director, Ziegler, Nashville, Tennessee.
I think we can go ahead and get started. This is the last panel in the M&A track, so I appreciate you guys joining us. We are sticking with the M&A theme, but we are going to try to distinguish this panel from the prior panels by specifically focusing on some of the implications surrounding genetic labs. So I have an esteemed group of folks with me today. To my left, my immediate left, is Patrick Walsh. Patrick is a managing director at Ziegler, which is a healthcare-focused investment bank specializing in M&A and private placement capital raising. Patrick's focus areas include the laboratory industry as well as the pharma services landscape, and his transaction experience in the lab space includes pathology practices, clinical labs, diagnostics, and technical business serving the laboratory sector, among others. He's also a digital pathology guru. We collaborate on a lot of digital pathology initiatives, which has been great. Prior to joining Ziegler, Patrick spent 6 years at a private equity-backed pathology platform where he was involved in a wide range of finance, M&A, operating, and sales functions. We also have Valerie Palmieri with us. Valerie is an experienced executive leader of high-growth, disruptive public and private biotech companies, serving as public company chair, board member, CEO, and currently CEO and founder of an international diagnostics strategic consulting practice called Momentum Consulting. She has successfully exited two startups and most recently was able to get the first FDA algorithm into two medical society guidelines, as well as added to a congressional law to ensure access for all. And then finally, we have Michael Vishnevetsky. Did I do it? I got it. Okay, I'm going to call him Michael so I don't botch that. Michael serves as Senior VP of Business Development and Commercial Operations at Fabric Genomics, with a focus on clinical lab partnerships and strategic alliances. Prior to joining Fabric, Michael focused on pharma engagement and companion diagnostics test development, serving subsequently as a head of global business development at Personal Genome Diagnostics and InVivoScribe. Prior to that, he held business development positions at Pacific Biosciences and Thermo Fisher Scientific, with focus on utilization of molecular assays and next-generation sequencing for diagnostics of rare disease and clinical oncology. And I just realized I forgot to introduce myself. I am Emily Johnson. I am a partner at McDonald Hopkins. I work with our healthcare group as well as our M&A group on transactions involving primarily labs and pathology groups, among other healthcare providers. So, in keeping with the theme for this session and focusing on the marketing trends and business considerations for genetic labs, I'm going to start with you, Patrick. From your perspective, what distinguishes genetic labs from other types of laboratories or businesses in the current M&A market?
Sure. Thank you. And I appreciate everybody coming today. I do think that when we focus on genetic labs, it is worth kind of getting some of the vocabulary straight so that we're not causing any confusion, because I think there are, you know, maybe two big buckets that these types of labs fall into. One would be, you know, kind of the very esoteric point solution type labs, maybe a single diagnostic or a limited menu, versus, you know, some of the labs, especially that we saw, you know, rise up during the epidemic and the COVID pandemic, and really meet that huge immediate need in testing, but labs that are more like a PCR lab that have maybe a couple of panels, but are you know. You know, maybe not as esoteric as, you know, kind of the myriads of the world. So, I think when we talk about M&A, those two buckets warrant distinct consideration. For the first bucket, I think that the to the extent that their technology is proprietary, that is the type of differentiation that may allow them to find more success in the M&A markets if they've developed something or have a unique contract or testing capability or maybe have even been deemed a companion diagnostic. There's a scarcity value there that may override a lack of more widespread contracting larger reference labs' abilities to develop their own tests. So I think, to the extent that any of these labs are going to be successful in M&A these days, I'd probably lean towards those proprietary platforms. On the other hand, I think that some of these more recently developed kind of almost like community PCR shops are the ones that are, I think, by and large, trying to find a path forward in the current environment. They rose up to meet the need for COVID testing, and for as an example, as a common example, and without a broader menu, without payer contracts, are now I think struggling to develop the full menu and the regular referral bases that can make them sustainable in the long term. So that they're going to find a little bit more of a headwind in the current M&A markets and maybe in the operating markets as well.
Thanks. I think that's really helpful insight. Michael, how about you from your perspective at Fabric Genomics as somebody who's directly in the genetic space?
So thank you. Tom had a really great perspective. We have many labs that come in, they made some money on COVID, right, testing, PCR testing, and they're kind of thinking what's next. And I think the 500 pages that came yesterday really upended a lot of the conversation. That's a lot of what I wanted to say, kind of I need to think twice, is that really the right path to go? At the same time, there is really no turning back, and you have to go forward. So I feel like still transitioning, designing a really good transition right now. Some of them actually have funds. So the plus, if we're talking about FDA and approval, you need to have some war chests, right, to go through that. Some of those labs do have it. So I would say, go with NGS, complex molecular testing. At the same time, spend some time figuring out what will be your next step. So I think it's really good. Right now, those labs still have their, and then you will be more valuable as acquisition targets because I think a lot of acquirers will be really looking, are you prepared for the new regulation? Because then you are much more valuable rather than, I just have a menu of 100 tests, but I don't know what's going on. So my perspective don't be afraid to go ahead. Just be mindful of hire the appropriate consultants, and go ahead.
Awesome. And Valerie, I know you're highly tuned into the genetic testing space. She just spoke like 10 minutes ago on the FDA final rule. So any additional thoughts from your perspective?
Yeah, I would say that, it really comes down to is understanding your end in mind. What is your exit strategy and what are your high enterprise value drivers? So it's understanding what you're going to be really good at, understanding what you're going to say is your specific IP piece, and then maximizing that, as Patrick just said. So it's really putting together a plan. I don't think a lot of labs understand their exit strategy, so you're going to exit via a strategic, IPO, M&A. What is that plan, and then how do you build your menu around that plan to drive the highest value? So it's really important to have that end-in-mind strategy, because I could tell you 9 out of 10 labs don't have it.
Yeah. And we see that all the time on transactions, that labs just really aren't focusing on compliance the way they should with an exit strategy in mind. And I know Crystal and Liz and those panels previously spoke to what you can do to prepare, right, in advance of going to market.
Yes, some of them just are there to make a quick buck, and they definitely don't have a strategy how to go forward.
Right, yep, we definitely see that. So, Patrick, What roles are private equity and venture capital currently playing in the genetic laboratory M&A space?
Sure. So, you know, I think that notwithstanding what any of the previous panelists may have said, I think to be very blunt right now, venture capital and private equity are playing very little role in laboratory M&A, relatively speaking. It's been a challenging market environment. But, you know, I think they're in the grand scheme of things, these funding sources are necessary for the development of these businesses. They're often there, to provide capital before public markets are available, to companies like these. I think that applies to both the, you know, kind of the esoteric point solution, you know, genetics labs, like Fabric. And also to, you know, some of the more local, local businesses. I think that private equity and venture capital are also there to help facilitate some of this M&A, you know, to the extent that these businesses are trying to find their path forward by gaining scale, broader menus, anything they can do to kind of get above the fray and get some escape velocity, they will seek capital. And frequently are not able to do it, especially if they're early in their development, with their cash flows, or with bank financing. So, like in, you know, many other industries, many other, parts of the lab sector, they play a necessary piece, and, there are frequently, specific private equity investment professionals and even, you know, entire funds and shops that specialize in, laboratory science, diagnostics, and things of that nature.
Are you seeing a general hesitation on behalf of the private equity groups to invest in genetic labs because of regulatory scrutiny and how enhanced it is right now?
Not specifically because of that in isolation. You know, I think that right now the markets are challenging enough that there is just a very high bar for whatever reason. I think that also, when it does come to the esoteric end of genetic testing, there is just always going to be a lot of scrutiny because there's going to be, you know, a lot of questions about the actual core science of this testing, and not as much expertise because, you know, it's esoteric for a reason. So, I wouldn't say that the regulatory scrutiny is the most specific acute pain point. That may now be different as of yesterday, but you know, there are a myriad of reasons, no pun intended, that these sources of funding can be difficult to find.
Yeah, Michael, how about you from your perspective at Fabric and somebody who's active in the market? What are you seeing with respect to private equity and venture capital trends?
So I totally agree with Patrick. It's not an easy time. However, when we went to JP Morgan, there was a pretty robust activity. It seems like everybody see the light at the end of the tunnel, and the genetic testing is here to stay. Whatever FDA does or doesn't do. So I think we just need to, as an industry, figure out what's the best path. It seems like, you know, the investor community really just as we are figuring out how to invest properly to minimize risk. And so, again, for me, if you attended Valerie's presentation, previous presentation, if do think about the regulation. FDA is here. It might be delayed, and I think it will be delayed, but we'll see how it goes. At the same time, the regulation is coming, and the smartest way is begin showing your potential investors that you're thinking about. You're thinking about the future. You're getting prepared. And so that will definitely help your valuation.
Yes. Just to kind of piggyback on that, I do believe that getting that ready in terms of your QMS system, really three parts, your QMS, your clinical validations, and your team will insulate you and protect you and actually make you, I would say, stand in the number one position in terms of investment versus number two or number three. So total agreement.
And one other piggyback comment I'd make specific to the reference to JP Morgan, I totally agree that, you know, that there is, you know, kind of this undying optimism from investor sources But they're just also kind of tactically, there is a lot of capital on the sidelines right now that is looking for a place to get deployed. That might be a little bit more specific to private placement investments, rather than M&A specifically, but, good ideas can get funded. Good ideas with, you know, well-built businesses and huge market opportunities.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's really important. Okay. I know we're talking about the LDT final rule, and I know you just spoke about it, so I don't want to make you rehash everything. And I know we've alluded to it a few times, but from your perspective, Valerie, and I don't know if you have any insights you want to share from your last panel for those who weren't able to attend that, but as a strategic consultant, with the FDA regulation that we're all still sort of digesting, what do you see as the greatest impact as a result of that regulation? And I guess from your perspective, what are the potential upsides and downsides associated with the regulation?
Wow, it's a loaded question. multiple parts. So I'd say a couple of things. I think one is, to Michael's point, I think it's here to stay. Number two is that we talk about grandfathering and carve out. Based on our team's review of this 528-page document, it is basically always been there. There's always been enforcement discretion. So for LDTs today, they were always under enforcement discretion, will continue. The key thing, as I mentioned, is really a 5-point plan, which I discussed, which is number one, understanding your exit strategy, your end in mind. Where do you want to be 3 years from now, 5 years from now? Building number two, a financial model behind that, with that exit strategy in mind and understanding the cost or the burden of a QMS, potentially new team members, and potentially more clinical validation. Number three is putting that plan together, that three-part plan together, and then really stepping back and saying, okay, what are our high-value products? What products should we potentially export and consolidate? What products should we aggregate? So if you have rare diseases, are there other rare disease labs that maybe you can look at an aggregation model? And then number five is really reconfirming your model, because this is going to be over time. It's going to be, I call it a phase out. I really think it's a phase in. And everyone has got to comply to this mousetrap. It's just a matter of time. And I do think one last point that I will say is that a quality management system, ISO 13485, really is affecting the entire operation from sales all the way through billing. So this really is a mandate that a quality management system has to live, eat, and breathe within your organization. And we as CLIA Labs, being the clinical laboratory scientist, we did not, sales could make changes on the fly, could change a brochure, could basically say this LDT was intended for this, but now it's intended for X versus Y. Those changes off the cuff can no longer happen. So I do think it's going to be a wake-up call for the CLIA laboratories once they prescribe to a QMS system. And the most important thing is start now so you're not behind, because you have to operate your lab and that plane is in flight and you have to change the parts.
Patrick, are you seeing any opportunities or, I guess, shortcomings as a result of the final rule?
Still in very early days, and yeah. You know, I think that the first thing we're going to have to do is understand all the carve outs, all the carve ins. I do anticipate that it'll have a pretty profound impact on the landscape. One example that I was discussing earlier today in a separate conversation was the carve out that may exist, and someone check me on my facts if I'm wrong about this, but the ability for hospitals to continue to perform their laboratory developed tests on inpatients, and whether or not that may also extend to a hospital's ability to care for another hospital's inpatients with the same LDTs. And if that is the case, that may kind of rearrange test referrals across the landscape. So that would be an example of just where volumes that had been going one direction are now going to get redirected another direction, and that will change people's top and bottom lines and valuations. So I think that would be one example of the ripple effects, and that I'm sure there'll be unintended consequences. But at the end of the day, I think it will create winners and losers.
Yeah. Valerie, I'm going to put you back on the spot. Can you fact check Patrick for us? Because
please do.
Yeah, so I think it's, again, when you read the regs, and literally we were reading on the flight, getting off the flight yesterday, I think it's going to depend on the specific LDT and whether it's specific to a rare disease. So it's going to depend on the disease, depend on the know-how. They basically created these regs to make them as open-ended. So I want to say reducing lawsuits, allowing people to still access care, but at the same time put controls around that care. So I think it's going to depend on the specific test and that disease state.
So we get questions like this all the time as a lawyer, and it's fun to pose them to other people. But knowing that there is going to be this pushback, litigation, all the scrutiny surrounding the final rule, how, other than, you know, having compliance plans in place, how specifically can genetic labs prepare for implementation of the final rule knowing there is this scrutiny? Like, are there particular areas that you think that labs should be focusing on right now?
Yes. So I think that number one, there's stage one and there's going to be stage two. Number one is going to be reporting adverse reporting. So they're going to have to report all their LDTs to the FDA. There's a 5-part plan, which is in the deck on their prior meeting, which all these presentations will be available for everyone. But they're basically, everyone's going to have to basically have their LDT signed up to the FDA so they understand. Number two is what is going to be your claim, right? So really strategically understand your LDT and understand what you are claiming in terms of the intended use. Number three is your quality management system. Is, again, understanding CLIA and CAP, it is much different, the QMS system requirements for FDA. So start on that as soon as you can, because it's going to help your organization not only today but tomorrow. And I think the key thing here is we have to continue to innovate as laboratorians. We can't sit still. So this mousetrap that's been built says, okay, your LDT is today. But if you modify or change technology within that test, that's going to require the clearance. So the key thing right now is get your quality management system in place so that when you want to innovate, you're ready.
That's awesome. So bringing it back to the concept of the M&A panel, right? What about for labs who are specifically or actively, maybe is a better word to describe it, going to market right now or in the process of a transaction, understanding there is still the ramp-up period for the rule and potential litigation, but what can those folks do now, probably as part of the due diligence phase, right, where these questions are going to be raised, what can they do now to materially comply with what not only the rule might require, but what prospective buyers are going to be looking for?
Who do you want to answer that?
Any of you.
I would vote for number one is if you've got New York State approved technology, that is golden right now. So if you have New York State approved or you're going to push that in process, get that moving, number one. And then number two is get your QMS moving. Because the sooner you've showed investment in that, it's a protection for those investors or for whoever's acquiring you.
Yeah, the other thing I would add is that, you know, I think we have to assume until we learn otherwise that investors and acquirers are going to be more adamant about the targets going ahead and getting FDA approval. It's probably a tall order, but having the capital necessary to either complete that process or to be in market longer as you work your way through the process, I think we have to assume that this is going to slow down deal processes and is going to, the targets are going to bear all the costs of that slower progress.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And I would say, as we know, the guidance is final. However, nothing is final, right? It can be modified. So if we're looking at European process with IVDR, right, they grandfathered a lot of more assay than they initially planned. So I would say don't wait. Try to get as many kind of assays that you think fit your model out there, because FDA might say, hey, you know what, we'll give you a little bit more time for that. And that happens again and again by different regulatory agencies. So if you feel that, as Valerie said, you have an expertise, let's say, in rare diseases, right, try to get some more of those rare disease tests out. Think about just submit to New York State, right? It doesn't need to be approved yet. So don't feel paralyzed by this regulation. I think the worst is just like, oh my God, I don't know what to do about it. I need to hire expensive consultant. You know, you have to, you know, be proactive. So I would say that's really important.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. So I'm going to kick this back to you, Michael. So a lot of labs were started during COVID, right? And those volumes have dropped significantly. Many of those labs now are converting to running molecular tests. What are some of the strategies for transitioning from a COVID testing lab to running a variety of molecular tests?
So I think right now, again, with all this new information, you know, really hire a reputable company, and there are some reputable companies that we know that can set you up for those high complexity NGS testing. Don't try to, right now, you better, your opportunity is to build this quality system from the very beginning, right? You have an advantage. You don't have a kind of the existing system you need to break. Start building it from scratch. I know it's, for some of them, it's, they don't have too much startup money, right? However, a lot of COVID labs actually do have. And so don't feel that you can delay this process, start it right away. And then, what we see, the labs are successful. They have a certain niche, right? They have a certain relationship with hospitals, right? It can be a geographical relationship. It can be more kind of disease-related relationship. And so just try to focus on your strength and build your quality system and have a kind of work with the lab design companies that, you know, we know a number of those who presented at this meeting. So don't delay, because the more you delay, the more probability that you'll have to go the full FDA route rather than the abbreviated one.
Valerie, what about from your perspective? I mean, I know you've worked with a variety of different genetic labs, so do you have any additional insight on folks who are trying to convert to offer additional molecular testing? I know you have a particular expertise in billing and coding and all of those related things. So,
I would say that I think it comes down to your customer base and really kind of understanding what you are good at. I could say it's really understanding your customer base. So whether it's the local lab, it's the service, understanding what your customer needs are and building based on those customer needs. And back to Michael's point too, if you have a rare disease test, that is your niche, and do everything you can to expand upon that niche, because you can actually be an aggregator of bringing in multiple patients on that rare disease nationwide. So think local, but also think, okay, if I have a rare disease, how do I become that aggregator of the rare disease? Because that's going to improve your enterprise value and the strength of your company overall.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to a question we got from the audience that I think is relevant to both what Michael and Valerie, you guys were talking about as far as improving the infrastructure. So speaking of technology and governance, is there a misconception of how long the IT conversion will take and what elements of governance need to be considered?
Oh, boy. Well, that's an operational question, so I'll take it. You know, IT is your central nervous system, and you know, it is actually the creator of your product. Your product is data. So how you determine your strategy, also you're determining your IT strategy at the same time in terms of what that delivery looks like. Whether you're decentralizing, whether you're doing a TCPC. So I believe your IT system again has to go back to your strategy and then working backwards saying, how can we build the highest enterprise value, whether that's to the payer, whether that's to the provider, or whether that's to the patient, and taking all that into account in terms of building your system.
The other thing I might add, I think that the general consensus is that as the cost of whole genome sequencing continues to drop, that there will be, you know, kind of a greater and greater business case to just go ahead and run the whole genome, rather than just, you know, select genes on the panel. And I think that also, getting back to IT, that's going to interface, so to speak, with a growing demand on the part of the referral sources to get that structured data returned back into their EMRs or their own IT systems. So, I think if I were doing this, you know, from scratch today, you know, I would be building my IT system with the capability in mind of being able to return that entire whole genome in a structured manner back to my referral sources. And that, of course, would be a heavier lift from an IT standpoint and would inevitably take more time.
Yeah. Do you have any?
So this is exactly what Fabric is doing. So I think the model is, as you correctly pointed out, Patrick, that if you can eliminate, so if you can just validate a whole exome, a whole genome, right, instead of validating multiple panels, that will, in the current environment, will save you enormous, potentially multiple submissions, right, enormous time. So the strategies has to be really evaluated and then have a, you know, AI system that can kind of just run through the entire genome, prioritize. So this is, I think, an opportunity to innovate. It's like from every challenge, there is a new opportunity to innovate. So maybe this FDA ruling will bring us finally to people converting to genomes, right? Because a burden of validate multiple tens or hundreds of panels becomes overwhelming. So that's actually really, I haven't thought about it, but maybe,
I think that will happen. I was going to say, I think that's the first positive thing I've heard said about the final rule, so that's great. Any other thoughts on the technology aspect, or we can move on to the next question? Okay, so, and we did get one more question from the audience, but I think the other sessions and the M&A panels touched on preparing to go to market and the need to have good advisors to maximize the ability to close the deal as quickly as possible. I'm going to allow each of you to weigh in on this, but what are the important factors for a commercially successful transition in the current market? Understanding we have a lot of uncertainty with the final rule, but based on today's market, what would you consider to be the important factors? And we can start. Whoever wants to go first.
Happy to do it. Might spur some other positive thoughts. The question was, what are the inputs into a successful
transition?
Mm-hmm. I think I'd probably refer back to Valerie's comments about beginning with the end in mind, and you know, I guess understanding that if you are building your lab to sell it or to join a larger organization, to have the systems, to have the products that can be compatible with a wide range of buyers, so that number one can have a lot of options when it does come time to sell and create the positive outcome that way, but then to have the tools available that whatever system you may be joining, you're in the best position to be able to integrate, if that's what we're talking about when we're talking about transitions. I would say that, you know, maybe the other piece I'd add to it is, you know, to the extent at the margins that you can think about your contracting, I feel like payer contracting is such a critical piece of the successful lab transactions that I see, that if you have any ability to be thinking through the, you know, assignability provisions, the various ways that you can structure your entities so that your buyer can step into them without having to get outside approvals that can slow down the transaction closing process. By all means, do those. Again, another very tall order, because a lot of labs are kind of taking what they can get with respect to contracting. But it thematically, it all goes back to that: begin with the end in mind, and start a couple years ago.
So just to piggyback on Patrick, I would say is, you know, there's a saying that I use, if you don't change practice, you don't get paid, is clinical utility. And when it comes to the payers, things are moving to value-based faster than ever. So as you look at your clinical studies, and if you have to redo your clinical validations, going back to Patrick saying, okay, you have to have the end of the mind, but at the end of the day, it's going to come down to, did your test change care pathway? Did it change the care? And focusing everyone in your organization, whether sales reps are collecting data from the providers, whether you're putting a registry in place to maintain your value, because at the transaction, you do not want to be discounted into a, I'm going to say, national laboratory framework. You want to ensure what brought your value to the table for the transaction remains, because at the end of the day, it will come off the bottom line. So don't change practice. You don't get paid, and maintain your value and understand that value and how it can transition to the new entity.
I would say positive cash flow. A lot of genetics labs still losing money on a regular basis, and the acquirers just don't like it these days. It's not about sometimes your top line, it's about your bottom line. You know, are you able to offer tests and get paid, right? So we know continuous challenges in getting paid. So as Valerie said, you have to find a niche where you do get reimbursed. The company, revenue management company who you're working with understands what they're doing. And so I think it's really, really important, your financial situations, your margins, in this tough environment that we're right now, this is very important. So I would definitely pay attention and know if you're getting paid, what are you getting paid for. We're dealing with different companies. Some of them have a good grip on that, and some of them don't. And so, that's very important at this moment of time.
And I think, Valerie, your comment about establishing that niche is a common theme in our discussions yesterday, Patrick, too, is really highlighting what distinguishes you from your competitors, right? And what you do that makes you better. And market that. Labs are so often seen as behind the scene providers, and even the patients don't necessarily realize the value or the workflow, right? Even though lab testing impacts literally all aspects of clinical decision making, highlighting the things that you do well so that you can distinguish yourself and people understand the value of your lab to increase that revenue. All right, we have a couple minutes left. Any final thoughts for the audience? Anybody that wants to jump in, and then we'll get to our last question.
So I think one of the few things that's interesting, and I will be speaking about it tomorrow, there are some new reimbursement opportunities, especially rapid whole genome sequencing in hospitals, dealing with NICU, PICU, and some others as well. So as a lab, kind of follow the trends, right? Really understand how the reimbursement landscape changing all the time, because as we discussed, the FDA approval is not a guarantee for reimbursement. Yeah. And that has to be remembered, right? Yes. So those two things, unfortunately, independent. So making sure that you have people who are like, oh, all right, this MAC started to pay for this, and like figuring out how you can work through that framework will really help you to be successful.
And Valerie's team really does that well. How are you guys staying on top of what the various MACs are paying and how you can leverage reimbursement?
So again, it comes down to is your clinical utility data, right? And having that, I'm going to say it's not even the analytical validation, it's your clinical validation, your clinical utility in terms of how did you change patient outcomes. So I'm not going to get into specific MACs, but there are definitely MACs that are more open, progressive, and there are MACs that are not. They've changed a lot of the regulations to make them more unified. But get ahead of it. Focus on what you want to be good at. Go deep, go narrow. Understand your niche in terms of what you're delivering, and then how did you change outcomes in the patients you touched, and publicize that. Put that into a publication. That's going to be your niche, because your test will be different than another lab's test. And making sure you have the power of the N of the data. You know, you see too many labs publishing very small data sets. again, it's going to take money, but if you've been around for a while, you probably have tested thousands of patients. It's understanding, maybe you have to get patient consent, but publishing that data and having a large data set to rely on, because that is going to drive your value.
And maybe just one other consideration to add, and I don't know, again, that this falls into the M&A discussions specifically, but along the clinical utility and, you know, kind of your retrospective data sets, I think people, you know, sometimes are not as thoughtful about the service element that surrounds the testing that they are providing, particularly around helping the referral sources interpret the test outputs that are coming back to them and how to make decisions based on that information. So, the clinical utility is only going to present itself if the physician or the referral source makes the right decision with the test that's been conducted. So being able to guide them through that decision-making process, it's an easily interpretable report, but it's also the resources at your business to consult with that physician or test orderer to understand how to interpret the data and make the decision.
Total agreement.
Yep, I agree. All right, our last question is sort of an open-ended one, but what strategies do you have for making genetic labs more lean and cost-effective? Michael, I'm going to kick that one to you first.
Oh, sorry.
What strategies would you have for making genetic labs more lean and cost-effective?
I think, Sarah, one of the things, making sure that you have a specific model. Some people just running around, oh, let's launch this. Oh, I see that. So you have to have a strategy, right? Just not to a perfect example, you launch some hereditary testing, and then you decide, oh, let's launch some somatic testing, right? And it's not exactly the same. There are certain differences. Your lab needs to perform. You need to hire certain technicians. So really have a good foundation, kind of technical foundation, then the regular foundation as well. So if you have, and then understand who are your customers, who are your, the patients. So all this good work is pre-work will pay out. So for me, it's everything that Valerie said is really important.
Any additional thoughts?
You know, I'm not sure there's any secret sauce, especially not that I can provide. I think it's about scale and automation and being really effective at managing costs. So industrial best practices, all of these labs are high overhead, low marginal cost, and what's going to make them profitable is scale.
Yeah, and I would just say, just to conclude this, is that put a blueprint. Make sure you put it on paper. So it's really a product development. When Abbott goes to launch a test, there is years of blueprints. We as laboratorians, the blueprint process doesn't exist to that point. So I say put a roadmap down there, understand your cost, understand your investment, and prevent rework. I see so many labs actually get through a clinical validation and then find out, well, we didn't have the right inclusion or exclusion criteria. Model out where your study is going to take you the best you can. Otherwise, you'll be left with nothing and you'll have to rework it. So minimizing your rework, I think, is because these specimens are invaluable.
Yeah.
And with that, work with partners. Find a partner. Don't try to do everything yourself. You cannot be an expert. And you'll see that actually the costs are pretty well manageable for those companies that provide those consulting services. So just be reasonable and ask for help when you need. There is a lot of people here to help.
So since we are the last of the M&A panels, I think we have the benefit of being able to bring this all full circle. And I think the common theme or a common theme that we heard today was whether you're in genetics, pathology, just a general clinical laboratory, when preparing to go to market or considering going to market, doing that well in advance. Patrick said start years ago. There's so much truth to that statement, and it's only going to expedite the transaction and increase the value of your organization. And so I can't emphasize that enough, working with, really great supporters, advisors, not just really great lawyers, but accountants, billing and coding experts, working with the right investment bankers to make sure that you are maximizing the value of your entity in advance of going to market. So with that, I want to thank my panelists for joining me today, and thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.